Welcome to Conversations for a Brave New World with Donna, Sonia and Cliff, where we bring you a global, national and local focus on gender, sexuality and feminism.
Hi, I'm Donna Bridges, Associate Professor of Sociology at Charles Sturt University. Today on Conversations for a Brave New World, we begin a new series exploring men and masculinities, the study of which opens up possibilities for personal reflection, institutional reform, and broader cultural change. It's a key component in understanding how gender operates in society. And joining me is one of Australia's most influential scholars in this field, Professor Bob Pease, who is a masculinities theorist, a social worker, and an honorary professor at both Deakin University and the University of Tasmania. Bob is an academic, a highly influential author, and an activist. He has numerous seminal works, including Undoing Privilege, Unearned Advantage in a Divided World, and most recently, Destabilizing Manhood and Masculinity and Interconnecting the Violences of Men. Bob's work challenges patriarchal power while also exploring what it means to be a man in a world where masculinity is both privileged and in question. Today we'll talk about the field of masculinities, rural gender norms, the problem of masculinities and violence, and the role men can play in building a feminist future. Thank you for being here, Bob, and welcome.
Thank you, Donna. Thank you. I'm pleased to be part of this podcast series. I think it's a great initiative, so thank you very much for including me.
Wonderful. Let's start at the beginning then. What do we mean, Bob, when we talk about the study of masculinities?
Well, there are lots of theoretical perspectives in terms of how we make sense of masculinity, not only interpret and make sense of, but even articulate and describe what we mean by masculinity. I locate myself within a kind of an explicitly pro-feminist stance. There are diversity of theoretical perspectives. There are diversity of political approaches. And I'm part of a field that identifies itself under the language of critical studies of men and masculinity. The focus of my work is on men as well as masculinity. And I would want to say at this point, we've given too much attention to masculinity as a way of talking about and describing the problem of men in the world and the problems that men create in the world. And I think it can sometimes distract our attention away from men's privilege and complicity with patriarchy.
For the listeners then, could you say what you mean by patriarchy?
When I was a young man in the 1970s, we talked about patriarchy much more commonly than we do now. We had a definition of patriarchy around men's greater control of social institutions in the public sphere, the unearned entitlements that men had in heterosexual marriages in terms of the privileges and associated with that. We saw patriarchy, men's dominance being linked to escalating levels of violence against women. And we talked about the kind of unearned benefits that men receive by virtue of being men. And a few years ago, I published a book titled Facing Patriarchy, and what I tried to articulate in that book was that there were five different dimensions or five pillars of patriarchy. There are these intersectional structures of gender relations, and these intersectional structures are interconnected with colonialism and neoliberalism and white supremacy in various ways, so that there's the structural level. Then there are the cultural dimensions of patriarchy, the way in which societies centre male values and masculinist values. Then there are kind of peer group level dimensions of patriarchy, the peer cultures among men. And then there's the familial level, the coercive control and unequal privileges that men have in heterosexual marriages. And then there's the deeply embedded element of kind of like a psychopatriarchy in men's psyche and subjectivity. And I think all of these different levels interconnect and intersect in various ways. I see it as actually a very nuanced and complex concept of the kind of the language when we're talking about men's violence against women. I argue we can't talk about that unless we talk about patriarchy.
You've talked a lot about privilege then, and I've heard you talk before about this topic, but men don't always feel privileged, do they? They can feel defensive when it's said that they have privilege, especially if they're working class or men of colour, Indigenous men, homosexual or trans men. How do you respond to questions like this?
When I first wrote the book on undoing privilege back in 2010, privilege wasn't really in the general discourse very much at that time. In the last 15 years, it's much more commonly talked about. And it is talked about in ways that I think have departed from the more sociological understanding of privilege now. I think a lot of the kind of privilege talk is a very individualized notion of privilege. And I think that there are some real limitations in thinking about privilege as simply an individual set of traits and behaviours and subjectivities, because we have to see the way in which privilege is structurally embedded. There's an overly individualising of privilege, so that's one issue, that is a limitation. Secondly, we need to, yes, acknowledge the kind of intersectional nature. And too often, when we see male privileged checklists, there's no intersectional analysis at all. And of course, you're quite right that, you know, if you're an Indigenous man or a working class man or a gay man or a trans man, your access to what Raewyn Connell's called the patriarchal dividend, which is the kind of way in which she talked about male privilege, is differential. Not all men have the same access to that patriarchal dividend. Not all men are equally privileged. And we certainly need to acknowledge the reality of the marginalised positions of many men. You know, and having said that, while acknowledging, you know, the way that working class men are oppressed by capitalism and Indigenous men are oppressed by white supremacy and gay men are oppressed by homophobia and heterosexism, nevertheless, those men still enact privileges. And so there's the intersectional dimension. The other thing is that, yes, coming to terms with and acknowledging your privilege creates discomfort and defensiveness. There's no question about that. And now, the fact that men are defensive about it, the fact that men resist the idea that they might have privilege isn't a reason why we should jettison the term. It simply means that we need different pedagogical ways of engaging with men's defensiveness. I mean, there's a tendency in a lot of the work about engaging men or promoting gender equality that there's a tendency to try to decrease men's defensiveness, to sort of emphasise to men, look, you're the good guys, you're the good men, and the real problem is those bad men out there. So we don't want to associate you with the bad men. I think the problem with that approach is that it doesn't encourage us to acknowledge our complicity as men with the systems of patriarchy. We start to see ourselves as the good men. And the problem with that is we then don't recognise our own connectedness to the problem. We don't see ourselves as part of the problem. Some years ago, I actually started running patriarchy awareness education workshops for men. And they were informed and inspired by the workshops I had done in the 80s around racism awareness education. And I thought, I found them emotionally powerful, engaging, unsettling, threatening. But I thought, when I started to think about pedagogically, how do I want to work with men, I was really inspired by the kind of anti-racist pedagogy, and I borrowed a lot from that. You can break through some of those resistances and create more openness to change, I think.
So it sounds like there's some real contested terrain here. As you talk, I'm thinking about terms I hear such as a crisis in masculinity where people are talking about and are concerned about men's health, suicide, men not being able to talk about their feelings or their problems. And then people also talk about toxic masculinity, particularly around the problem of violence. And that's not always a helpful term. It's certainly a contested one. So how do you make sense of that? On one hand, we have a crisis of masculinity, and on the other hand, we've got what people call toxic behaviours.
Look, I don't really think that there is a major crisis in masculinity. I don't think Trump has a crisis of masculinity, for example. I don't think ruling class, the most powerful men, have any kind of crisis of masculinity. I think that different times there are crisis tendencies within patriarchy, and there are certainly costs for men of adhering to dominant forms of masculinity. I mean, I think you're quite right. I mean, men have higher rates of suicide. Men have higher rates of alcohol and consumption and drug addiction. There are unintended consequences for men adhering to dominant forms of masculinity, but I don't think that's a crisis in masculinity as such, because I think a lot of men still do the cost-benefit analysis and tend to think, look, even if they're aware of some of the costs, they think the privileges outweigh the costs, and that if you want to try to engage men in change by saying, a lot of the approaches for engaging men to say it's in your interest to change, you will benefit from change. A lot of men don't see it that way. And I do think we've got to foster in men a greater ethic of care and a greater social justice ethic, that men ought to change and acknowledge their complicity and address their complicity in patriarchy, whether or not they benefit from it or not. But the language of toxic masculinity is a term I don't like, because I think it implies that masculinity has a toxicity to it. It's almost like a virus that you can catch. And in contrast to this kind of so-called toxic masculinity, we're encouraged to foster a kind of healthy masculinity. And this is now the main strategy of a lot of violence prevention work, including with government programs like Our Watch and Jesuit Social Services and the Man Box. I mean, a lot of the current work around engaging men is to suggest that if we foster a healthy masculinity, we'll reduce men's violence against women. I think healthy masculinity is an oxymoron. I think itself is a contradiction. And I think that the problem with it is that in a patriarchal society where you've got an unequal gender binary, where masculinity is privileged and elevated and aggrandized and affirmed, and femininity is devalued and marginalized, that alternative healthy masculinity is still going to be in a hierarchical relationship with femininity. And fostering in men a notion of a healthy way to express their masculinity, for me, is still reinforcing the unequal gender binary. And it's also reinforcing the notion that masculinity is tied to men's bodies, because I think women do masculinity too. Non-binary people do masculinity. And I think it takes our attention away from the structures of patriarchy. You know, it's so much easier to suggest to men, oh, we should foster a new masculinity, than it is to suggest to men, you should address your complicity with patriarchy and work to challenge patriarchy. Much more threatening, much more challenging. I'm going to get much more pushback in suggesting that. But I just think this notion of healthy masculinity is a distraction.
Mm-hmm.
Takes our attention away from the kind of broader structural problems of the violences that men do.
And asks the individual man to do something about his own self rather than look at social structures.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that individual men need to look at themselves too. Men need to look at them, the way in which they deeply internalize patriarchy into our psyche and our subjectivity. But I think we need to look at our complicity with the structures. And part of the educational process that I'm engaged in with men is not about developing a new masculinity. For example, I do some local work as an activist in Merribeck community in Melbourne. We've been organising a series of public forums and running workshops on 20 things men can do to challenge patriarchy. But what can we do? 20 practical things that men can do to challenge patriarchal practices and attitudes. And not one of them is about developing a new form of masculinity.
That's interesting. So I'm thinking now about masculinities and rural areas. We broadcast from a rural location, so we're interested in what people call a rural masculinity that is common in regional areas and rural locations. We have industries here that favour masculine jobs and masculine ways of being, and many people have identified that both men and women embody masculinities in regional Australia, and that rural men are said to be different to urban men. Do you have any comments on this?
Yeah, look, I do think masculinity manifests itself differently in rural communities. Rural men tend to internalise more deeply embedded patriarchal belief systems and sense of entitlement in relation to women. Not that rural communities are homogeneous by any means. I do think there is significant research now that indicates that rural men tend to be more sexist and homophobic. We know that there are high levels of violence against women in many rural communities, and that that violence is more privatised, more likely to be covered up. The issues in rural communities are different. I mean, we also know that there are higher levels of alcoholism among men in rural communities, higher levels of gun ownership, representation of rural men are real men. Men who work on the land, men who work with their hands are seen to be, again, I'm putting my inverted commas signs up when I talk about real men. So yeah, I think there are differences. So I think these ways of engaging men is more challenging, and I've certainly found that myself when I've been invited into rural communities to do engaging men in violence prevention workshops. Mm-hmm. I've certainly encountered deeper levels of resistance to change, deeper, more deeply embedded kind of misogyny and sexism among the particular groups of men. Again, emphasising that not homogeneous, of course, there's diversity and difference, but certainly that's been my personal experience in rural communities.
There is certainly an established link between rural masculinities and violence, isn't there? In rural and regional areas, it's quite normalised and legitimised that in order to be a real man that you do assert dominance, maybe over women, the land, animals, Indigenous people. So let's take that as an invitation to talk about men's violence. I'm interested in the fact that we use the term violence against women much more so than we use the term men's violence. So what is the problem of men's violence, Bob? This is a big area of your work.
Yeah, I think that it's much more challenging to gender who's doing the perpetrating of the violence than it is to identify who are the victims of that violence. And yes, you're absolutely right that it's much easier to talk about violence against women than to talk about men's violence against women or men's violence more generally. And I do think that, you know, you're mentioning some of the other kind of violences that men do, and there are interconnections between the violence that men do to women and the violence that men do to boys and other men, and the violence that men do to Indigenous people and to queer folk and to the violence that's enacted against animals and the violence that to the planet, to environmental and ecological kind of damage that men do. I think all of these violences of men are interconnected in various ways. And in a book I co-edited recently, which you mentioned in the introduction, which was Interconnecting the Violences of Men. We set out to explore those interconnections. And I really believe that we ought to focus on much more on the way these different violences are interconnected, rather than seeing men's violence against women in a very siloed kind of way. I understand why we give focus to this particular form of violence by men. But at the same time, we need to recognise that the violence that men do to women is just so connected to the violence they do to other men. And in fact, if you're a man, you're more likely than if you're a woman to be subjected to other men's violence. You know, we often forget that. Mm-hmm. Men are vulnerable to other men's violence just as women are. And I would much like to see a kind of focus on the violences of men and the way they're interconnected. And I actually don't think we're going to really address men's violence against women until we start to see how it's interconnected and how we need to address violences on multiple levels, including the kind of structural violence against women too. I mean, the focus of so much of the violence prevention work in relation to violence against women is the interpersonal violence that men do, but the kind of structural and state and police violence, mm-hmm. also enacted and reproduced and perpetuated by men, tends to be not addressed at all in violence prevention work. So I think we need to broaden out our understanding of what constitutes violence and look at its deeper and more interconnected manifestations.
Legitimised state violence.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
About, and in yeah. that way, men's use of it is quite condoned, isn't it?
Indeed, it is. I mean, violence in war, in mm-hmm. militarism. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So, a final question for you, and a big one: what role can and should men play in feminist work in ending men's violence?
Look, I think that there is a really important role for men to play. And at the same time, I think it's important to acknowledge that there's understandable caution, suspicion, distrust by women of men involved in this work. And I think that's a well-founded suspicion and distrust. I think that often when men have got involved in violence prevention work, we haven't done our homework. We haven't really sufficiently explored our connections to patriarchy. We haven't given sufficient acknowledgement to the women who've come before us doing this work. We haven't recognised the role of the leadership of women. We haven't drawn up lines of accountability to women's services. When I do workshops with men, I'll only do them in the presence of women who sit as observers, observing the work, observing where there might be complicity. So I think there are real dangers that we should acknowledge when men get engaged in this work, that we can neglect a kind of feminist analysis and marginalise the feminist framework. We can sometimes I've seen men's groups competing with women for limited funding. And of course, we get put on a pedestal. I mean, there are so few of us as men doing this work. You know, we get put on a pedestal and get all these accolades and acknowledgement for doing what we ought to be doing anyway. And so we need to recognise those dangers. We need to start by educating ourselves. And we can do that by reading books by women, engaging in feminist literature. And I encourage men to read novels by women. Even when men read fiction, they predominantly read male writers. We need to educate ourselves. We need to learn more about feminism, learn more about patriarchy, and we can do that not only through reading but through other forms of engaging with women's culture, films, plays, podcasts, listening to podcasts like your own, for example, and women's music. So engaging in the women's culture And that enables us to become more aware of our privileged positioning. And we need to walk the walk. We need to do our fair share of domestic work and childcare. We need to stop interrupting women when they're talking. We need to firm women's leadership. We need to apologise when we invariably, as we so often do, stuff up. Yeah, and also we need to challenge other men. There was research done a few years ago that where it was discovered that the vast majority of men, if they found that their best male friend was perpetrating violence against his female partner, they wouldn't challenge him about it.
Mm-hmm.
It was shocking. Part of the issue is we need to reconfigure our relationships with men. We need to challenge men when they express misogynist and sexist statements. And certainly when we become aware that they're being abusive. And so there are very practical everyday things to take on board.
Well, thank you, Bob, for being on the show. This has been a perfect start to our series on men and masculinity, so I really appreciate you being part of it. And you have definitely left us with a lot of food for thought.
Okay, thanks, Donna. Great to meet you, and very pleased to do this.
I'm now joined by my colleague, Sonia Maria. Sonia, that was a very interesting first episode in our new three-part series, Masculinity Matters. What stood out to you the most in terms of what Bob Pease was saying?
Yeah, I thought it was a fantastic interview, Donna, one of our best for sure. Really, really interesting discussion. I can't help but feel a little bit negative coming out of it, which is sad because it was so interesting. But I felt like, some of the discussions that were being had, I don't know the solution, maybe I'm not meant to, I'm not an expert in the area, but, I am a feminist and I'd love to see more men being feminists as well. But I just don't know if the incentive is there for them to be able to change and be able to move away from privilege. And I find that upsetting. Because I'd love to know how can we fix that?
Well, I think Bob's right. We don't talk about patriarchy anymore. We don't talk about patriarchy nearly as much as we used to. We do talk about gender, and we talk about gender equality. How do we get that? Which really is a liberal feminist agenda, isn't it? And it's also reforming the system that we're in. And I think Bob is talking about changing patriarchy as a system of power and privilege where men expect to be able to dominate women in one way or another. So even if they agree that you should be able to have the same job and have the same rights at work, there still might be some privilege being activated in the home.
I agree. You're still expected to come home, cook dinner, do the majority of the housework and everything else. It's not a shared, equal environment at home, but it might be changing at work because the law says it has to. But in our personal lives, it may be just the same as it's ever been.
There is an expectation that women will give up work for a little while. Somebody said that to me about the daycare crisis at the moment. That women want it all. They want to have the children and they want to be able to leave them in daycare because they want the jobs. And really we need to look at it like two people are having the children and two people need to make the sacrifices and maybe do some flexible work. But that's about changing the system too and changing people's attitudes to who really has the responsibility of the children. And men have always been able to have it all. They've always been able to earn the money, have the great job, have the kids, have the nice house. They've always had it all. So, like you said, how do we end that level of privilege?
Well, I think, talking about complicitness was interesting and men standing up against other men, speaking up. I think that's probably a small thing but could probably go a really long way because it's changing the expectation, seeing it, calling it out, and even just being more aware of what's going on, I think, is a start.
So, great show.
We look forward to inviting the listeners to come along for the show next month when we have Michael Flood and Stephen Burrell also talking about masculinities and talking about masculinities and violence.
Sounds great, Donna. Looking forward to it.
Thank you for listening. This show is brought to you by the Gender Network. To get involved or find out more, simply Google the Gender Network at Charles Sturt.